This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Fred Waitzkin about a new novel of his called Deep Water Blues. Fred's the author of Searching for Bobby Fischer. I think that's probably your most famous book, but you've written several other novels as well. How are you doing, Fred?
I'm doing great. It's great to talk to you, man.
You as well. So I read this book. It was really interesting. It comes off as very personal. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think you are right about that. You know, no matter how I try to write a book, it tends to always come out a little personal. You know, I sometimes people ask me, you know, who are your great literary influences? And I love a lot of authors, but like the honest answer to that question is my mother and my father. They were my greatest literary influences. So I guess that leads you into a pathway about the personal connection that I have to my books.
Well, and yes, I mean, I would like to ask you about your mother and father too, but this particular book takes place in the Bahamas, and it clearly is, because there's so much detail in it that's realistic, it feels like you've spent a lot of time on boats in the water, you know, in those waters in particular. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about, you know, how that worked. How'd you end up spending so much time on fishing boats, or, you know, private boats, I guess, in...
It's kind of an interesting story. You know, my mom, who was a great sculptress, Stella Waitzkin, great abstract painter and sculptress, and my father was a salesman, and I grew up on Long Island, and when I was, you know, my mother was always kind of like feeding me art and poetry and novels, and my father was telling me about the greatness of salesmanship, wanted me to be a salesman. So on my mother's side of the ledger, when I was 13 years old, my mother took a copy of Life magazine that was a couple of years old and put it in front of me and told me to read Ernest Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. And when I read it, I was just intoxicated by the description of catching a larger-than-life fish in the ocean. And also, I was similarly intoxicated by the beauty of his language. So at a fairly young age, I got this idea that big game fishing and writing were connected. And so that's where it began for me. And then throughout my life, I owned boats, little boats, rowboats, and then little outboards, and then bigger boats. And my father always had a boat, and I was out fishing with him, and then I got my own bigger boat. And so I've been fishing my whole life.
But there's a big difference between, or at least it seems to me, a big difference between fishing off of, now, would it be Long Island Sound or on the ocean side of Long Island?
No, Long Island Sound.
Okay, so, but, you know, I grew up on Long Island Sound, so I consider, you know, I understand those waters. Very different, it seems to me, than going into the deep water, you know, the real water. And, you know, the Bahamas are 400 miles off the coast of Florida, right?
It's true, but you know, for a kid, there was something very magical about fishing in the Long Island Sound. It was dirty water, and you didn't know what was in there, and and you dropped your sandworms, and oh my God, something tugged on the other end, and it was like a miracle. And an eel would come up, or if I was very, very lucky, it would be a striped bass. And so, I mean, it was such a magical mystery tour for me as a kid. And fishing is that, even in the Bahamas, where the water is gorgeous and clear, but also very deep where I fish. I'm a deep water fisherman, so you really don't know what's down there, even though the water is beautiful and clear. And you always, you know, putting your nickel in the Nickelodeon, and what comes out is like intoxicatingly exciting. And you never know. You never know what's gonna grab your line, what isn't gonna grab your line. So I mean, even though they were very different, fishing it's got that magical quality. No matter where you're fishing, I think.
And I guess this is another question that always comes to my mind. You know, it just seems like it's a major undertaking to take a boat as far as, I mean, you have to have a boat that's big enough. And what is a boat that's big enough? What's the size of a boat that you would be talking about in, like, you're, in this story, you're cruising around in that area, frequently. So what size boat would you have to have in order to do that?
Well, it's not exactly have to have. I mean, you know, people have done crazy things with boats. I mean, you know, people have taken 12-foot boats across the ocean. But my boat is a 40-foot, it's 40 years old. It's an old 40-foot Hatteras sport fishing boat. Hatteras is a very nice make boat. It's an older boat, but I've maintained it over the years. It's like a member of my family. It's very seaworthy, so if I get caught in a storm or in a big sea, unless I'm foolish or I'm in too big a storm, I'm going to make it through. And that's a good-sized boat to do what I do. I mean, it's not a lot of people use bigger boats, but I feel quite safe, and my boat is comfortable enough to live on for weeks at a time. So that's a, you know, that's a good-sized boat to do this with.
So in a 40-foot boat, which I think is a fairly good size, I agree. How long can you go on the water before you have to go fill up? I mean, is it diesel or gas?
It's diesel.
So how many, you have two engines?
Two engines. Well, you know, that's an interesting thing about having diesel engines. If you go slow, you can go for a long time. If you go fast, you burn up the fuel very quickly. Like if I go at trolling speed, in other words, if I travel at the speed that I would like to pull baits in the water to catch fish, and which is what I do, I travel from island to island fairly slowly, I can stay out for almost 2 weeks. But if I travel fast, I can burn up the fuel in a day and a half.
Right. But part of this whole endeavor requires planning. You have to know how far you can go. You have to know what the next port is that you will get fuel in. And I assume
Absolutely.
Also water, fresh water you have to get, and food. So you can only carry so much in terms of supplies. So part of this, I'm just kind of trying to get a feel for what it's like, you know, when you do this stuff, because at least for me, it's not anything I've ever done. And I think I assume a lot of people who are listening, this is foreign territory too. So trying to just get an understanding of what it's like to be out in those waters on a boat, which seems, I mean, 40 foot is big, but it's not huge.
It's your own little world, David. You know, the territory that I write about in the book, which is it's called the Out Islands. I mean, there are islands, Bahamian islands, that are very close to Florida, like Bimini, for example, and which is a wonderful place. I've been going to Bimini since I was a kid, and that's only 45 miles from Florida. So you can go to Bimini and you can get food there, and as you suggest, you don't need to have you don't have to bring a ton of supplies with you, but in this adventure to this island, which was quite an adventure, because I made this trip with three other guys that knew very little about boats. So I was really the experienced person on the boat, and the captain of the boat. Normally when I go so far, I take an experienced crew with me, but on the trip to Rum Key, the last trip to Rum Key, I took three guys that were, they were all, you know, on the older side, and they hadn't been to sea. One of them had been, but many years before, and the others hadn't been at all. And so, you know, there were inherent risks in it that I don't usually take. Taking an inexperienced crew is, by its nature, a risky thing to do, because running a boat like that, it requires teamwork. And if everybody in the boat doesn't know what to do, you can get into a lot of trouble. And also, when you go to the Out Islands, you need to carry your supplies with you. You don't go to Rum Key and think you're going to buy groceries there. There's nothing there. There's no fuel there. So you have to plan it out very, very carefully.
And well, part of the story, I mean, we're going to get, as we've talked before we started recording, don't want to give away too much of the story, but it takes place on this place called Rum Key, where there is a guy, an entrepreneurial guy, building this, I don't know what to call it. It's not really, I mean, maybe it's a resort, something like a resort. And this story is really about him and this sort of tragic life that he lives and things that happen to him. So since you've mentioned that the trip to Rum Key was a true story, I assume that most of the events that happened there at this place are also true. Is that correct?
You know, it's a very interesting, this book was a very interesting departure for me in a number of ways. And if you don't mind my backing up a little bit, I'll tell you how I got to it. I began my career as a I began my career, you know, with my mother at 13 years old writing short stories. And you know, when I graduated college, I decided that I would be a fiction writer. And I spent some time trying to write short fiction, but I didn't really know what it meant to write short fiction when I was like 21 or 22 years old, just graduating Kenyon College. I used to think that you had to sort of like pull stories out of the trees, like, you know, like they had to fly into your head and you had to imagine them. And I couldn't think about what stories to write. And I kept, you know, I thought in my early days, well, they must relate to dreams. But my dreams were always very depressing and people weren't interested in publishing them. And then I spent a number of years doing journalism. I wrote feature journalism for a lot of big national magazines. And that was a fantastic training ground for me, because what I learned was that stories were everywhere. You had to find a story, and you had to research it, and then it could come to life. And this revelation of actually finding stories rather than thinking that you had to imagine them out of whole cloth really influenced my approach as a novelist. And in terms of this particular story, the genesis of this story was that I'd been traveling to this island, Rumkey, for 20 years or more. And when I first discovered it, it was a paradise. It was a tiny marina where there was room for like 20 or 25 boats. And many of the boats were owned by very wealthy people. And very famous athletes would come there for vacations, like Mark Messier and Dale Earnhardt. Jackie Onassis came there. There were a lot of famous people that came there. It was physically gorgeous. It was a lush island that had hills, and there were wild cows that roamed around the island. It was really a paradise. And there were so many fish there that it was almost like cheating to fish for them. You could catch them easily. And then, beginning with a tragedy that took place some years ago, and I won't describe the tragedy because it's an important part of the story, but a terrible thing happened near the island, really terrible thing. And after this, in an almost mystical way, the whole character of the place changed. It darkened. There was a kind of like, the soul of the place turned very, very dark. And the personality of key players on the island turned very, very dark. And a generosity kind of turned into greed and anger and violence, and ultimately even more than that, without giving away the plot. And so I knew I wanted to write this book, but I was confused about how to do it, because I sort of had the story of Rumkey in my mind for a number of years, and I tried to write it as a novel, and it wasn't coming off. And then there was a strange segue that took place in my process. About 3 years ago, I was asked to write an original screenplay for a couple of producers, and I did that. It took me a couple of years to write the screenplay, and I'd never written a screenplay before, and I had to learn a whole new medium. I had to learn, you know, to give up the style in which I write long, complicated paragraphs for very short sentences, for no flashbacks, for very quick movement in plot, and off this kind of training ground of writing the screenplay, I returned to the story that had been haunting me for a long time, and all of a sudden I could write it. I mean, I wanted to write it like fast, with no flashbacks. The action on the island very, very fast, moving ahead, and that sort of gives you an idea of how I approached the book.
Well, and I noticed that the storytelling is very. It is cinematic. I think that would be the word I would use, that it's, you know, it does read not as a, as you said, it's not, there's not a whole lot of, there aren't flashbacks or immersions into all of, you know, kind of sidelines or long pontifications about the meaning of life. It's really action based. But it still is about the characters, I think. It's just, I think the reason I wanted to ask about the boat and the kind of background and setting so much is that it's so integral to the kind of ethos, which is, you know, it's definitely a foreign one for so many of us, you know, those like me who've never really spent that much time, if any, on those kinds of boats in that particular place. So, you know, it's sort of exotic in its outlook or setting in a way that, you know, you kind of, it does look like a movie in that sense, you know, where we've seen movies about stuff, you know, all these mysterious things that happen on islands and, you know, odd people that it attracts. I think that's part of the story is the interesting characters that you come across in a place like that.
Well, the other thing, the other part about it, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I when I was planning the book initially, I didn't think that the traveling to the island was going to be a part of the narrative, but the traveling to the island actually became a counterpoint, and I realized that, you know, halfway into the trip, that the characters on the boat were so interesting, and the travel, you know, to the island. I mean, in a way, if you think of Conrad's Heart of Darkness, you know, the traveling up the river, we were sort of doing that a little bit.
Yeah.
And that became, that juxtaposition became very, very important. The other thing in the book, which is very unusual, and I think I can tell you this without your readers or our readers giving anything away, is that I had this idea that it would be very cool to take real characters like myself, Fred, and I'll mention, and John Mitchell is another character. John Mitchell is a friend of mine that had never been to sea before, and he's a guy in his middle 40s. He's a realist New York painter. He's a brilliant painter. He works on canvases for years at a time, and he's fantastically good. And I invited him on this trip because I had this idea that it would be very cool for him to do drawings and paintings of what we saw along the way and put some into the narrative. Because, you know, in the 19th century, it was very usual for novels to be illustrated. I mean, Charles Dickens novels.
That's true. Although, as you have in this book, those illustrations were often sketches. They were meant to kind of help you be placed into the physical locale, because I think the assumption in the 19th century, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but the assumption there was that the readers would not have a frame of reference because they didn't have television, they didn't have movies, they didn't know what those places looked like. And so I think the sketches were there just to help you feel like you could put yourself in those places. And in a way that it does make sense that you've done it in this book, because these are places that most of us, even though we may have seen movies and we may have seen Life magazine as you did, they're still somewhat unknowable or unknown for so many people.
Right. I think you've described it beautifully. The other element about it that was interesting was that, this was an idea that I was playing around with, before I started writing the book, is I thought it would be very interesting to take real characters like myself and John Mitchell and Duran Katzman and the guys that travel on the boat and bring them into a world that is at least partially fictitious. Now, Rum Key is not fictitious. It's a real place. And in general, the story that I tell is a true story, but I very carefully describe on the book jacket that it's a story that was inspired by a true story. In other words, I'm not writing a history. I'm telling a story that was inspired by events that actually happened. But I've taken a lot of license with the story. But still, in all, I thought it was very interesting to take real characters and introduce them into a story that's at least partially fictitious and see how they interplay. That was kind of like part of my design.
Yeah, no, I think that's a reasonable fictive decision to make. I think the tricky part for the reader is insofar as we know there are real people involved, it's trying, you know, it sometimes will get you to start thinking about where the reality and where the fiction are, where those lines are. And not necessarily that's a bad thing. It just causes us to think about it. I think all fiction, you know, as I've talked to a lot of writers, all fiction is true, but it's not necessarily true to actual events.
It's such a great point. I've been thinking a lot about this point lately. In fact, I even I wrote a piece for Writer's Digest about 2 weeks ago, in which I called something like, I don't remember the title, but the whole idea of it is there really fiction, to the point that you just made? Because, you know, and I think a lot of people from the outside don't really think it through, but like, I was reading an interview about 3 weeks ago in the New York Times with Thomas Harris, the guy that writes about Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
And he says in the interview, this is close to a direct quote, I don't write anything that I haven't seen in my own life. Now, I think what he means is, I mean, I don't think he actually ever saw Hannibal Lecter, but I think what he means is that he's seen things in life that at least inspire aspects of Hannibal Lecter's character.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Stephen King would say the same thing. All of those things are the imagination of, they're versions of a reality. They're not necessarily literally true, but they're effectively true.
Exactly. And this, you know, maybe I didn't enunciate this clearly enough 10 minutes ago, but I didn't understand this when I was starting out. You know, when I was in my 20s and I was trying to write short stories, I didn't think that, you know, I didn't think that fiction was in our reality. I thought it was kind of mystical, that you had to kind of create it like making up fairy tales. And coming to this sort of like, when I came to understand this in my own terms, it opened me up as a writer. That was when I really made progress.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's a really important point that helps us grapple with our, you know, our emotional, our lives, our emotions, our psychology. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, you look at fiction as working out problems in some way, whether it's directly or indirectly, and or working out challenges or emotional conceptual frameworks that the writer's doing, and their writer is bringing the readers into this imaginative world to live in that same space. And it doesn't really matter whether the story is how true the story is, or how kind of it true to life it is. That doesn't really matter. It, you know, there are different ways of stylizing that, but I think fiction is all, and of course that's a vast generalization, but I think in the end, fiction is really, it's just human experience told in a different way.
Right. I think you described it beautifully.
Well, I wish I could write fiction, but I'm stuck reading it. I can't write. So,
you know what a revelation to me, maybe I should have known this 30 years ago. At one of the museums in New York about a year and a half ago, there was a show about Ernest Hemingway, and they had manuscript pages pasted on the wall all over the museum. And I was dumbfounded to see that when I was reading, when I was looking at pages from The Sun Also Rises, that in his first drafts, he called Jake Barnes Hemingway, and Lady Bret Ashley was named for a friend of his. And all the characters were friends of his in the first draft. And then, of course, as he rewrote the book and deepened the book, he changed them into fictional characters. And I'm sure that their characters deepened and went their own way also. But you know, and similarly about Hemingway, I started this talking about The Old Man and the Sea and how important it was to me. But when I was only many, many years later did I realize that great novel was born initially from a short article that Ernest Hemingway wrote in Esquire magazine, where he describes this event that took place between an old fisherman and a marlin in Cuba, and that Santiago, the old man in the novel, was based upon a man that was still living in Cuba at the time. So much of what we call fiction is really based very firmly and then modified a little bit in reality.
Well, that's true. And I think that's why, you know, people who are friendly with or connected to or married to or in the same family with a writer, it can get tricky. You know, there are occasions when you find yourself in someone else's novel and you really wonder, is that how I appear in real life to other people? Or is that even how I am imaginatively viewed by someone I love? That can be hard.
That's a great point. And, you know, writers get into trouble with writers over the years. I mean, I've had that experience myself, where I've been depicted in another writer's work in a way that made me uncomfortable. And then the writer came to me and said, well, how do you feel about this? And I said, I don't feel great about it, but it's your right to do it. I always say it's your right to do it. Not that it's happened to me so many times, but it's happened to me a couple times. And that's always my answer, because I've made people uncomfortable in my writing.
No, I think that's a kind of necessity for the artist. I think artists would say this, it's kind of emotionally powerful, but you have to be true to your art. And sometimes that overwhelms or dwarfs your concern about the people involved, which is why sometimes great artists are not really the best people to be around.
You know, I wrote a memoir called The Last Marlin. I guess it came out about 16 or 17 years ago. It was at the end of my mother's life. It was, in a couple of sentences, the book is about growing up with a salesman father and an abstract artist mother who basically abhor one another throughout their marriage until they finally divorce. And when I showed it to my mother, it was amazing. The first time that she read it, she loved it. And the second time she read it, she absolutely hated it. She was enraged the second time. She loved it the first time. And because I said things in it that made her uncomfortable. And I said, but you told me. You taught me when I was a kid that I always had to tell the truth when I write these novels, at least an inner truth. And what isn't true?
Right.
So this is to your point.
Yeah, it's fine to preach telling the truth until the truth hurts you. And then, you know, then you have to deal with the consequences, I guess.
And a funny aspect of it, you know, because I think you pointed out earlier that I'm in this novel, but I always sort of find my way into books that I write. And people ask me, how do you write about yourself like that? You know, because I kind of take my pants off in public, and I say, I'll tell you how I do it. I write about Fred as if he's another character. He's just another character out there. His name is Fred. Until the book is published. And then I say, oh my God, did I actually do that?
Yeah, no, I think that's I think that's hard. I don't know how you do that. I think that's really, you know, it's difficult to imagine putting yourself in your own story without being as honest as you are. I think that's hard for other people to understand.
Just the way I said, I pretend it's not me.
Right, but eventually you sort of look at yourself and say, okay, now I have to deal with what I just said.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, this is actually really fun because we've ended up talking about so many different things, all related to this book, all related to your story, but we haven't given away the story, which I think is really important. And I think it's really good that we're able to demonstrate that this book, which is, it's a fairly short book, can bring forward so many really interesting ideas about life, about writing. And of course, that doesn't even touch on some of the elements of the story, which I think are pretty powerful. So I think...
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing about this book and this story is that, and maybe I touched upon this when I was saying earlier that I was very influenced in the movie writing that I did when I got to it. That the thing that inspired me so much about the story was the story itself. I mean, the yarn. Forget about what I wrote. The story itself that I heard about before I went to approach this novel was such an astonishing story. The transformation of the island, the transformation of the people, what they did to one another, moving from kind of a Valhalla to a place of tragedy. I couldn't believe the story, and what I wanted to do when I wrote this novel was to render it properly, to render it accurately, rather than mess it up with like a lot of, you know, complications and, you know, literary paragraphs. I wanted to tell the story well, because it was an amazing story.
It is an amazing story, and I want to give you credit for that, because it is, it's a very powerful story of human behavior. And of course, that's what makes great storytelling. That's what's behind all of Shakespeare. So I appreciate that. I think it's a really fun book. Well, I don't want to say it's a really fine book. I think there's some elements of it that are fun, but a lot of it is also kind of tragic and painful.
I appreciate that. So, thank you very, very much.
That's well, beautiful. Oh, thanks for talking to me about it. It's been great having this conversation. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Fred Waitzkin about his novel, Deepwater Blues, and I hope you'll go out and read it. Thanks, Fred.
Thank you very much, David. I loved this talk.